Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Good morning, it's Wednesday the 3rd of August. Welcome to this edition of Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, South Africans vote in municipal elections, seen as a test for the ruling ANC.
I'm going to vote. I need a change there. I need a house, LTP and electricity also.
Madiba tells us that the only change we got is to vote for the party that you believe for.
No, I'm not voting. Too much corruption in this country.
And Rwanda is losing ground in the fight against malaria, with health officials recording an increase in new infections.
The main problem is lack of access to malaria-treated mosquito nets. The nets are no longer distributed as much as they were in the past.
Also on the programme, we'll be hearing why some parents in Ghana would like to see mobile phones banned in primary and secondary schools. Stay tuned.
Top story.
South Africans are heading to the polls in local government elections that are being seen as a test for the African National Congress, the ANC, which has ruled South Africa since the end of apartheid. The outcome may also be regarded as the electorate's verdict on President Jacob Zuma's performance in office. The main opposition party, the DA, has been upbraiding the ANC for neglecting Nelson Mandela's legacy, prompting an equally vigorous response from the ruling party. There has also been pre-election violence in which 12 people were killed. From Durban, Subri Govende reports.
President Jacob Zuma, leader of the ruling ANC, has crisscrossed the country singing this freedom song at every opportunity. He promised his party would improve lives by providing decent housing, drinking water, electricity, public health services, and education for the vast masses of the poor living on the margins of society. But with many citizens growing increasingly disillusioned with their president, who has spent the last few years embroiled in corruption scandals, opposition parties are gaining support. Polls suggest the Democratic Alliance, the main opposition party, could win key municipalities, including Pretoria and Johannesburg. But some of the party's campaign tactics have caused controversy. Its charismatic leader, Musi Maimane, came under fire from critics for invoking the legacy of national hero Nelson Mandela in election speeches, referring to him as Tata, meaning father in the Xhosa language.
Utata even warned us. He said the ANC would one day turn its back on the people of this country. And Njengutata Madiba once said, and I quote, if the ANC does to you what the apartheid government did to you, then do to the ANC what you did to the apartheid government.
Zuma and the ANC, who see themselves as guardians of Mandela's post-apartheid South Africa, countered this by also turning to history. Speaking at a campaign rally, the president recalled the DA's origins in predominantly white politics.
No white party can run this country, no matter how they cover up by getting a few black stooges. Remain the bosses. They remain a white party.
Playing the race card in an attempt to appeal to black voters also caused trouble for radical leftist party, the Economic Freedom Fighters. One of the party's local government candidates caused a storm after writing a Facebook post in which he called for white people to be hacked and killed. He was removed as a candidate by the Independent Electoral Commission, and party leader Julius Malema had to withdraw his party support for the candidate.
We're not going to get involved. Anyone who contradicts the Electoral Act in the name of the EFF, that person is on his own. And we are happy that the IEC is taking action.
But while the main party leaders and their parties have been using all kinds of tactics to garner support, prospective voters have expressed their concerns about the lack of proper delivery of services, lack of security for people in their residential areas, and wide-scale corruption.
I'm going to vote. I need a change there. I need a house, LTP and electricity also. They're promising us, but we're still waiting. I think there's corruption because they not give us that what we want.
Madiba told us that the only change we got is to vote for the party that you believe for. The water scarcity of water, electricity, those problems are very, very, very sad. Corruption is a big issue. I don't even think we have a power to change the corruption.
No, I'm not voting. Corruption is too much corruption in this country, in this government. No, all the politician parties are same. All are crooks. They want the money only. They don't care about us.
What the people are looking for, they want the deliveries. If they don't deliver, then people will start toying. Looking for electricity, water, schools and housing and also employment.
When most South Africans first went to the polls in 1994 to cast their ballots, they looked forward to a future that would be free of poverty, unemployment, corruption and racial divisions. But in the run-up to Wednesday's local elections, race has become one of the main campaign issues. Zuma's invocation of race as a campaign tactic led to criticism that he had betrayed the vision of Mandela and other freedom leaders who sacrificed their lives for a non-racial and democratic society. Political analysts say Zuma's use of the race card will only further drive a wedge among the people and further entrench racial enclaves.
Sobri Govender reporting from Durban. But what effect will these local elections have on national politics? Isaac Mugabe put that question to Philip de Wet, editor of the Mail and Guardian in South Africa.
Well, these are by far the most fraught local government elections that we've ever seen in South Africa, and arguably some of the most fraught elections we've seen since the advent of democracy in 1994, simply because the African National Congress, which has had a decided grip on both the national government and all but one of the provincial governments even, seems to be slipping ever so slightly. It's being attacked from both the left and from the right, both the official Democratic Alliance and the upstart economic freedom fighters are taking away some of the gains that the ANC has seen in previous elections. That, of course, has thrown the African National Congress into something of a tizz. And implications may include the future of President Jacob Zuma if his party does poorly enough.
We understand undecided voters and disenfranchised youth may prove to be decisive factors in the outcome of the local government elections. Why is this the case?
Well, typically, as elsewhere in the world, you see very low turnout at South African local government elections. People just aren't that bothered about voting in for their municipal managers. This time it's different. This time there is something at stake. So we expect high turnout from both young people who traditionally don't vote and who have registered in droves, and from the undecideds, the people who don't have strong feelings one way or the other, but want to be part of these battles for the battleground metros that are coming up. Also, there seems to be a very tight balance between, for instance, the Democratic Alliance and the African National Congress in places like the capital city of Pretoria. So really, we're expecting a range of alliances to appear after these elections, and some of the smaller parties may end up being kingmakers.
These elections are a big test for the upcoming presidential elections, aren't they?
They are indeed. President Jacob Zuma faces internal party elections in 2019. We've seen a lot of maneuvering ahead of that already. And there does seem to be two clear factions within the African National Congress, the pro-Zuma faction who are trying to manage the situation, who are trying to prevent major losses in these elections from coming to count against President Jacob Zuma. And then the anti-Zuma faction, who really want to make him the sacrificial goat and want to use a poor performance in these elections as a pretext to get rid of him once and for all.
How has Malema's Economic Freedom Fighters Party positioned itself to win some council seats?
It is quite clear that the economic freedom fighters will win some council seats. It is not clear whether it will be in command of any municipal areas, however small. So it may not be a governing party, and certainly it won't be a governing party in any of the major metropoles. But it may just have a large enough turnout to be a kingmaker in places like the capital of Pretoria or in the all-important Nelson Mandela Bay. And that may propel the party into a whole new level.
Given the frosty relationship between the ruling ANC party and the Malema's EFF, can we surely expect an alliance between these two?
Previously, both the ANC and the EFF have dismissed as completely ludicrous any suggestion that they could be in coalition. There is very, very little talk about coalition and alliances. It is perhaps no stranger for the EFF to ally itself with the African National Congress than it is to ally itself with the Democratic Alliance. All of these parties have been going at each other hard. All of them have mutually incompatible policy positions. But somehow governments will have to be formed.
Philip Duet of the Mail and Guardian in South Africa.
News, analysis, and feature reports. All that here on Africa Link.
In Nigeria, an inquiry commission has accused the army of killing at least 350 Shia Muslims and dumping their bodies in a mass grave in the northern city of Kaduna last year. The commission, set up by the Kaduna state government, said those responsible for the killings should be prosecuted, confirming the findings of an earlier report released by rights group Amnesty International. Isaac Mugabe has been talking to Kabir Aduma, a security analyst in Nigeria, and began by asking him how likely it was that those responsible for the killings would be prosecuted.
Given the antecedents of the Nigerian army, I would say very unlikely. Even though the present government has restated its commitment to ensuring that due process is followed, and if we look back at the inaugural speech by President Buhari, he committed himself and his government to following due process, including retraining the army and ensuring that the rules of engagement are reversed. But I would say it's very unlikely that we would see any form of prosecution to the extent that it would appease the both local and international community.
Now, in case nothing is done to bring the culprits to book, how could this raise religious tensions, especially in the north, that is predominantly Muslim?
Well, very unlikely. You should understand that the profile of Nigerian Muslims is tilted towards the Sunni Muslims. I think I won't be wrong if I say probably about 95 or above percentage of Nigerian Muslims are Sunnis. And the deep-rooted rivalry between the Sunnis and the Shiites is as such that a lot of Sunnis, unfortunately, are not sympathetic to the current Shiite cause. Having said that, on the side of the Shiites, even though they are in the minority, it would further their agitation. Even this morning, there was a protest in Abuja, where I'm stationed, demanding the release of their detained leader. So we're going to see further protests along that line by the Shiite group. But because they're in the minority, that's not likely to have a significant impact in terms of the religious divide within Nigeria.
Can you briefly describe the relationship between Sunni and Shia Muslims in Nigeria?
It's one of deep mistrust, I would say that. For lack of a better word, I would say they are mutually... They cannot exist in the same cocoon. It's deep mistrust. To an extent, some people will even describe it as hatred, and it's unfortunately expanding by the minute.
The Nigerian army has in the past been accused of human rights abuses. Is President Buhari able to root out human rights violations within the army?
We should hope so, and to be fair to the army, they have taken some bold steps that we've not seen before. They have established community relations units. They have appointed senior ranking members to head this community relations unit. They are engaging in some military civil relation projects, all in a bid to expand their relationship. What we are not seeing or hearing is training that is geared towards improving the ethos, if I use that word, of the military profession, to make the soldier understand that his primary responsibility is the protection of the civilian.
Nigerian security analyst Kabir Adamu.
Behind the headlines.
Ending malaria epidemics is one of the United Nations sustainable goals that it has set itself for the year 2030. But last year, 2015, 188 million Africans contracted malaria, of whom nearly 400,000 died, suggesting that malaria's eradication is still some way off. In Rwanda, there has been an alarming increase in new malaria infections, as Nazra Bashumba reports from Kigali.
Despite government efforts to sensitize the community on the best health practices to prevent malaria, cases of the killer disease have increased. According to Rwanda's government, the number of infections has doubled each year since 2013. The head of the Malaria and Other Parasitic Diseases Division from the Minister of Health, Aimable Mbituyumuremyi.
From 2013, we noticed an increase in malaria cases, but also in deaths due to malaria. In 2013, every month, when we have high peaks of malaria cases, we could not exceed 100,000 cases for malaria. But now it has been increasing over the years. And for 2014, it was almost double. And 2015, around 500,000 cases in December. It has been doubling every year.
According to the statistics released by the Ministry of Health, 1.5 million suffered from malaria in 2014. That figure rose to 2.7 million in 2015. According to the World Health Organization, part of this increase may, however, be due to a better reporting system within the country's health system. Dr. Joseph Murunziza runs an online health information portal that provides evidence-based information on the health system in Rwanda. He told DW that there was a lack of consistency in Rwanda's approach to malaria prevention. He also noted that although most Rwandans have health insurance, some families are still unable to afford it.
The government had almost reached a point of eradication. It required a consistent and continuous struggle so as to make sure that we tackle each and every case of malaria. Two, even though people have medical insurances, public servants, the citizens in our villages, but there's also an issue of co-payment. There are some families that might not be able to afford that co-payment, and that hinders them to seek medical attention timely.
Jean Damumbo Nishuti is a local resident in the eastern province of Rwanda, an area with high malaria rates. He blames the infections on the poor use of mosquito nets and the failure of the ministry to distribute the nets.
The main problem is lack of access to malaria-treated mosquito nets. The nets are no longer distributed as much as they were in the past. So some people have very old nets and others have never used any. Many people also lack the knowledge of how they can protect themselves from malaria.
In Rwanda's Ministry of Health, the rise in malaria has also left its mark. Last month, the country's former Minister of Health, Dr. Agnes Binagwaho, was forced to step down amidst accusations of mismanagement of funds and corruption. She was criticized for having authorized the purchase of 3 million substandard mosquito nets. In his report last year, the Auditor General also singled out the Health Ministry and its linked institution, Rwanda Biomedical Center, as government bodies that had grossly mismanaged resources.
Nazra Bashumba reporting. You're listening to Africa Link, coming to you from Deutsche Welle in Bonn. Ghanaian education authorities want to ban mobile phones from schools. They say the ubiquitous devices are a nuisance and keep children from doing their schoolwork. However, some parents and activists disagree. They say keeping children away from phones and the internet will undermine their creativity. Isaac Alechi in Accra has more.
Scores of students on break at this community school south of the capital city, Accra.
a couple of them carrying mobile phones. These students are now the subjects of a new campaign by school authorities. Ghana's Education Service wants mobile phones barred in secondary schools. The topic is a major subject of discussion among these students who seem not ready to give up their mobile gadgets.
And my mom bought me the phone in order to get contact with me and also to do some research due to my course I do. Well, I spend a lot of time chatting with my friends and getting contact to what's going on, more than my books.
My parents, to do research and contact them when I'm in need of something. Actually, I use only Facebook and WhatsApp, just chat friends.
The school authorities say students with smartphones spend more time on social media platforms than on educational sites. The education service says this is negative impact on the academic performances of the students. The Director General of Ghana's Education Service is Jacob Ko.
The worry is so immense that I will not have to close my mouth without telling parents all and sundry that the effect of mobile phone on learning is not a mean thing or a small thing to be underscored. Could we imagine the number of hours or minutes students use in the night, probably doing WhatsApping? And what are they even looking for in the internet? Is it relevant for their studies?
But Awo Aidam Amenya, a parent and executive director of J Initiative, a child development-oriented organization, disagrees with the education service. She says planning to prevent students from having access to phones will be counterproductive to their creative abilities and total development.
It's just a general blackout for the children that, okay, don't have access to this and all of that. But I don't think that is the best way to go about things. Because when we do it that way, we kind of hinder the child's creative abilities and we restrict them too much. They tend to hide things from us.
Awo wants education officials to encourage students to get innovative in their studies with the help of mobile phones. But Ghana's Education Service Director Ko thinks otherwise. He said that parents should rather not buy expensive gadgets for their kids.
In my home, unless my child completes secondary school, he will not use mobile phone. And you will never be any time behind the technology. So it depends on how you handle the technology and where it is handled.
The education ministry is yet to push for a total ban on the use of mobile gadgets. Teachers, however, have the discretion to confiscate smartphones in class, even though it isn't officially illegal yet.
Isaac Kelechi in Accra.
Opinion.
And for opinion today, we return to our top story. South Africans are heading to the polls to elect new councillors and mayors in a vote seen as a test for the ruling ANC. We would like you to tell us what you think those newly elected councillors and mayors should focus upon if they are to improve the lives of ordinary South Africans. And do you think forming party coalitions should be the way forward rather than the dominance of a single party if social problems like health and education are to be resolved? Do send us your opinion by email to feedback.africa@dw.com, a letter to Africa Link DW 53110 Bonn, Germany, or an SMS to country code 49160 957 595. A reminder of our main stories before we leave you. As we've been hearing, South Africans head to the polls in local elections in a vote seen as a test for the ruling ANC. Rwanda is losing ground in the fight against malaria, with health officials recording an increase in new infections. And we've also been hearing why some parents in Ghana would like mobile phones to be banned in primary and secondary schools. And then we come to the end of this edition of Africa Link. For more stories from Africa, do visit our website, dw.com/Africa. From me, Mark Caldwell. Bye now.